This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. While the majority of Americans do not believe gun control or gun safety alone would solve the problems associated with gun violence, 81% of Americans support background checks, 63% support a ban on so-called assault weapons, and a majority also oppose concealed carry of weapons without a permit. Even most gun-owning Republicans say they support these things, and yet no number of votes, phone calls to senators, protests, or lives taken has led to meaningful policy changes. Joining us now is Julie Weber, professor of politics and government at Illinois State University, who's been studying school shootings for more than 20 years. She's the author of Beyond Columbine, School Violence, and the Virtual. Professor Weber, welcome to The 21st Show. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Brian.
Listeners, once again, 800-222-9455 if you want to join our conversation. Eric tweeted at us at 21st Show, Second Amendment is framed to protect people from tyranny from government. However, this rhetoric and social construction of this right allows for an atomized tyranny from mass shootings. At what point will politicians understand this? Why is this terror acceptable? 800-222-9455. If you want to join us, 800-222-9455. So, Professor Weber, there's a real disparity here between advocacy surrounding gun control and action. Why is it we've seen no legislative action? What's going on here?
Well, I think John had it right earlier in the segment that it really is about the Republican Party really having a lock on this. This is one of their major issues. This is how they get reelected. So they'll probably filibuster it in the Senate, like you said. And I just want to mention, I don't know if you mentioned this earlier in the show, but I think it was under George W. Bush that I don't know if the assault weapon ban was allowed to expire or if he removed it in 2005. And that is really when a lot of this takes off. In terms of these mass shootings and this kind of cultural obsession with the Second Amendment at a level that is not seen prior to that.
Yeah, I believe it was allowed to sunset or expire in 2004. And so, yeah, this is hard to believe that even just, what, that's 20 years ago, that these sort of weapons were banned in the United States, right?
This is all, you know, you can sort of debate about whether or not Karl Rove designed this. Karl Rove was George W. Bush's political strategist. But he really did design this small state opinion dominating representation at the federal level and exploited it for the Republican advantage. So that's why you have this disconnect between, you know, the majority of Democrats and even, you know, sort of moderate Republicans favoring, you know, common sense solutions to gun control. But the policy at the federal level just goes nowhere because it's such a hot button issue for the party in order to keep, you know, maintain their kind of lock on control at the federal level.
Maybe we should be explicit for some of our listeners who maybe haven't thought as deeply about the structure of the Senate since high school civics classes. Right. What exactly we're talking about when we say small state bias and, you know, say, you know, the number of votes in the Senate Illinois gets as compared with Wyoming.
Right. So what happens is these smaller states have the same representation as larger states, even though they have less people. And people in those states, you know, don't have the same views as the majority of people throughout the country. So what happens is they're able to control the Senate, not necessarily the House, but the Senate is where all this legislation gets stuck because that's the second place it goes after it sort of originates in the House. And they're able to block it by using the filibuster because you have to have a majority to take it to a vote. So they never take it to a vote. It's not that they'll never take this legislation to a vote. It's not that it's not originating and folks aren't trying to put it together. It's that it never gets to a vote.
And this is what happened after the Sandy Hook massacre a decade ago, right?
Exactly. And yeah. This tragedy in Texas recently is so close to Sandy Hook. I mean, in terms of everything. It almost seems like, an attempted copy of that. It's very disturbing. And I don't know, one thing that can happen, if you want to hear something positive, or a strategy, one thing that can happen is electing people at the local level or the state level can change some of this dynamic, because they're the ones, the local party operatives are the ones that then, sort of change the political dynamic within those states. So, and they contribute to the gerrymandering problem, which we should probably explain that too. And why these smaller states have more control, and why politicians who don't actually represent maybe the whole state in terms of their views end up rising to the top. And that's because of the way that districts are redrawn. And if more Democrats or moderate Republicans were to be elected at the local level, so think about doing that if you want to, then they wouldn't be able to engage in gerrymandering and allowing these kind of almost colorful personality politicians to rise to the top and go to the federal level and represent them.
Right, because when you have a district that's drawn to, have 70-80% Republican voters, or contrary, 70-80% Democratic voters, the call of competition's in the primary, right? Who can be the most, right, convincing version of whatever the party ideology is at the moment. Let's talk a little bit about the National Rifle Association and their role in the gun debate. How have they played a factor in, if they have, in blocking the responses to these massacres, right? We have to do something, everyone always says, and yet it never happens.
They have such a huge presence in our national culture. And one reason for that, again, we can go back to the George W. Bush administration and the Supreme Court decision in Citizens United, which gave groups like the NRA equal speech, right? Corporations are seen as people. They have free speech rights. So the NRA has had morphed into this kind of organization that used to be a gun safety organization. I had mentioned this the other day on one of my on the show I was on. When I went to sixth grade camp, the NRA supplied our targets for gun safety. And a lot of longtime members of the NRA are confused by what it's turned into, right? Because it used to be a gun safety organization. So now that it supports, the right to all these assault weapons and to collecting and all of this, it's not the same organization it once was. And it has such a voice in American politics. And it, obviously it's also catered to by politicians, right? I think, was it Senator Cruz or maybe another one was going to go to some kind of an NRA talk on Friday, and they didn't cancel their appearances there. And in some ways it's kind of horrifying, because it's like they're taunting people who are struggling with this, which I find cruel and just kind of really not just insensitive, but it's sort of actively triggering people, right? Who are really confused and just mortified by what's happened to our country with these shootings. So it has an enormous presence. It's morphed into something else. It didn't help that it had Charlton Heston as its spokesperson for so long. And it looked like, a few years ago, it was probably going to lose a lot of its support. But I think it's still around. It's still there. And it's still being catered to by these politicians.
Well, it had some internal problems, and maybe that's a separate conversation for another day. Yeah. But I think at this meeting, the director, Wayne LaPierre, was pretty overwhelmingly voted by the board to stay in power. 76-member board there, which is maybe by design. You get some inertia with that. But not to get too far afield, let me just remind listeners, we're speaking with Julie Weber, professor of politics and government in Illinois State, who's been studying school shootings for more than 20 years. I want to talk a little bit. You mentioned a little bit earlier about that it almost this seemed like a copycat of the Sandy Hook shooting a decade ago. And, there has been a lot of attention on the way the media frames and covers these issues. We in the media have been advised to pay a lot less attention and really almost play down the person who carries out the attacks in these cases. Can you talk about just the framing of these tragedies and how that's shifted over the years?
Absolutely. And it has changed some, and I'm glad that the media is getting these messages. But I do think that, you know, now we have social media, and if someone is, you know, interested in doing something awful like this, they're going to find, you know, the information that they want on social media, you know, on a Reddit thread or somewhere now. And that's very unfortunate. And that's another thing that you can see that this really took off after YouTube became very popular. So, you know, a lot of these past perpetrators would put themselves on YouTube, or they comment on social media before they go and engage in their horrific crimes. But I think social media, you know, is now taken off in terms of giving them the script that they need. That's what I call it in my book, to follow. And they're really trying to, it's like a game. I mean, they're really trying to, these disturbed individuals are really trying to increase or improve their, I don't know how else to say it, score. And so in the case of Texas, it seemed very odd to me that this was a very large school with only, I think, grades 2 through 4. And something like over 500 children. That seems like a lot of kids. And it's an elementary school, which is just like Sandy Hook. He attempted to murder his grandmother before he went there. Adam Lanza murdered his mother before he went to Sandy Hook. There's just some very similar things in terms of, there's also some similar things to, I don't know if you know, Red Lake Nation, there was a shooting in 2005, I think. I see some similarities to that one too. So that's part of what's happening. So if the media could frame it, you know, in terms of focusing only on the victims and their, you know, families and care, you know, how as a nation we should care for these people. We should feel with them and really de-emphasize the perpetrator and anything that they've done.
I wonder if that, though, somehow lessens the pressure on the public officials or, you know, the way the media handles these things to, you know, shift the narrative away from the potential for legislative action to deal with these, to try and prevent these tragedies.
Sure. I mean, and there's all kinds of them, you know, that are happening. I think, what did I see? An article that there's been, you know, 11 over the weekend. You know, they're not the same kind of event, but we have mass shootings all over this country. And that goes to having, you know, over 400 million guns, as John Shaw said, in circulation in this country. So, and people, you know, are, you know, they're going to pick that up. And do that. So I think that it's the media does need to talk about it, but maybe more generally, like, why do people feel the need to first resort to violence rather than resorting to communication to solve their disputes or to solve their problems? You know, focusing on what people need in terms of community, focusing on community building. If the media did that, I think that would be something that would be positive and might help, actually. I mean, we have not much community in this country anymore. Most of our institutions have been pretty much gutted by the market. You know, people feel abandoned, I think. And there's just going to be people like this perpetrator that, you know, have probably been let down really seriously at some point in their life. And I'm not excusing it, but I'm saying that we can't know where they are. So one way to do it is to build more community. And we've pretty much abandoned that idea for the last 40 years.
Last thing I want to ask you about, and our time is running short, but how the idea of, I know you've looked at the role of guns as symbolic objects and how mm-hmm. that complicates attempts to sort of impose rational, you know, debate on this topic.
Right. I mean, they're almost, I'm going to use the F fetish. They're almost fetish objects. Like, you know, I think a lot of these perpetrators collect them. I don't know why people feel like they need to have, you know, 50 guns or hundreds of rounds of ammunition. It's certainly symptomatic of insecurity, a certain kind of insecurity. And I think guns represent, for people who feel weak, they represent a kind of armor or power that they can't build for themselves in their own lives and in their personalities. So it's actually very sad. And guns become a way that people communicate. Defending guns becomes a way that people communicate and avoid the issue of their insecurities. So I think that, guns really serve a weird kind of purpose in American culture in a way that they don't anywhere else in the world.
Yes, as a British reporter was confronting Ted Cruz last week, a very unique and dark form of American exceptionalism. Julie yes. Weber is a professor of politics and government at Illinois State University. She's been studying school shootings for more than 20 years and is the author of Beyond Columbine, School Violence and the Virtual. Julie Weber, thank you so much for being with us today on the 21st Show.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Coming up after a short break, we're going to be talking about the motor fuel tax in Illinois. The General Assembly froze a planned increase, saving drivers a little bit of money per gallon. They also wanted retailers to put a sticker on their gas pumps, giving them credit for that. Gas station owners do not like that idea, at least some of them. They are suing so that they won't have to. We'll talk about their case and their prospects in court after a short break here on the 21st Show. Do stay with us.